Maybe I'm at work and a guy has interest in me and I have no interest in them, but I encourage it because I want them to do something for me at work. Or maybe the opposite. Maybe I'm attracted to someone at work and they have no interest in me and I passive aggressively punish them because they're not reciprocating how I feel. If you're in a relationship, are you using sex as a punishment or as a reward? So many of us in Overeaters Anonymous, we have so many body issues that we're thinking, well, I don't want to have sex with my boyfriend because, you know, I'm disgusted by my body. Well, I'm depriving that man of what is different between a sexual relationship with somebody and a friendship is sex. So because of how I feel about myself, I'm depriving my partner of that. So I just want you to think about it more globally. Where am I being selfish? Where am I being dishonest? Where am I being inconsiderate? And then it's asked, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? So once again, you're just acknowledging yes or no, yes or no, yes or no. Now we had a sick man's prayer for the resentments. We had a fear prayer for the fears. There are three sex conduct prayers, three relationship prayers. And it just shows you it's complicated. It's complicated with when it's with another person. So the first one is on page 69, the second full paragraph. It says, in this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask, so here's the prayer. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. So when I first read that, I thought, well, that's damn easy. He's got to be over 6 feet tall, blonde hair, blue eyes, kind of surfer dude-ish. I know that. It's not asking me what is my ideal for the other person, not who I want in a boyfriend. Who do I want to be as a girlfriend? Because what I really saw was I had a very sick interview process, and because I was sick, I was attracting sick guys. I remember a sponsor saying to me, the problem isn't that the sick guys are asking you out. The problem is you're saying yes when they do. So I had to know who I want to be as a girlfriend. Now, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit into step 10 and 11 because the way that I look at these steps is this becomes relationships, not just sex conduct in 10 and 11. So I actually have created ideals for all parts of my life. Who do I want to be as a daughter? Who do I want to be as a sister? Who do I want to be as an employee? Who do I want to be as a member of Overeaters Anonymous? Who do I want to be as a political activist? Who do I want to be X, Y, and Z? And then at night, which we're going to talk about later, when it's asking what could I have done better, what corrective measures should be taken, I now have what to look at. Here's my ideal. Here's where I was today. This is the gap that I'm going to try to get to. So we're asking how to live up to them. Then it goes down to the next prayer. Whatever our ideals turn out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. Once again, we're human beings. A couple lines down. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if you want it. So how many of you have been married for over 10 years? I hate you all. No, just kidding. So if you got on the altar and said, I do, and didn't change at all, and never talked to your spouse again, do you think you'd still be married today? Relationships change. So what am I going to do in each specific matter? Who am I as someone who's newly dating versus engaged versus a newlywed versus, God, when you become a mother and a father, that whole relationship changes, right? I have a lot of friends because of my age that are starting that empty nest syndrome and they're having to relearn who they are as husband and wife instead of mom and dad. You know, those are the things that we're going to be asking in to these prayers. And then the last prayer is on page 70. The second full paragraph, to sum it up about sex, we earnestly pray. So first we asked, then we meditated, now we're going to earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. We see this over and over in the big book. It doesn't say, if sex is troublesome, call your sponsor. Go to a meeting. Say the Serenity Prayer 14 times. It says, go help somebody else. Because in step three, what did we learn? Selfish and self-centered is the root of my trouble. What is the best way not to think about me? Is to think about you. So whenever the big book is saying, whenever we're feeling shaky, go help another person. Just to backtrack, one of the things I do with sponsoring, this is me too, this is not specific to the big book. One of the things I do is when we get to these different prayers, steps, I instruct my sponsees to call newcomers and share that experience. Because you now have an experience. Tell them what it is to do a third step. Tell them what it is to do a fourth step and not have to do a big autobiography. Tell them what it means to have 100% abstinence. Because you're going to reinforce that experience. I don't know about you guys, but like I'm having a good time here. But I'm sure when I go home, I'm going to be talking about this weekend, and I'm going to get to relive this weekend. It's going to become a permanent part of my memory because of talking about it with other people. That's why by helping others, we're reinforcing our own experiences. So the last part of that inventory is once we've done these prayers, is what should I have done instead? I know for me personally, a lot of the stuff with the romantic relationships, it was two themes. If I was lonely, I stayed with guys way too long because I didn't want to be alone. But the other big one is if I really, really liked them, it scared the heck out of me and I ran. So I had to be willing to stay when I was scared and leave when I shouldn't be there. So now I'm going to go over something more general. On page 70, that first full paragraph, it says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. So this is in general, not just about the sex conduct. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to do better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experiences. So I'll give you an example for me. A lot of the ways that my resentments, my fears, my sex conduct, my relationships manifested was through gossiping. Does that mean that I've never gossiped since I recovered? Nope. But when I gossip, I immediately go into 10-11. I clean it up. I get connected with God. I don't feel I'm going to relapse because of that. But like I said, there's a lot of stuff going on at my job right now. If I decided, screw that, I'm going to gossip because this company deserves it. They deserve to be ripped apart. Am I going to eat again? Probably. So when I create these ideals of who I'm going to be as a daughter, as a sister, as an employee, if I continue to act in the opposite, if I continue to indulge in my character defects, I can't get comfortable that way. And when I can't get comfortable, the only thing I do is seek ease and comfort in the food. I think I might have mentioned, but I'm just going to say it again, that line from the doctor's opinion, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. As a recovered woman, I am still an effect person. I need an effect. My alcoholic mind is a sick mind. But I can get relief through 10, 11, and 12 and get the effect from that. I do not need the effect from the food. But if I choose to not work these steps, I'm going to go back to the only thing I got the effect from. Right now, I am convinced of two things, that I am experiencing permanent recovery and I never, ever have to eat again as long as I do these steps. I am also equally convinced if I stop doing this step work, I'm probably 3 or 4 days away from a relapse because I know what I suffer from, and my mind cannot stay in that state for any length of time without getting relief. So let's go down to the last full paragraph on page 70, and I kind of call these the four-step promises. So I'm going to kind of compare this to what I felt after doing inventories in other methods. So if we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. Once again, thorough. Did I follow the exact instruction versus did I write enough to publish War and Peace? We have listed and analyzed our resentments. Once again, listed and analyzed, not getting overly emotional in this stuff. We have begun to comprehend their futility and futility. Absolutely. I started to see, once again, I'm living in the 80s. I don't want leg warmers in my big hair back. And I don't want these resentments back. I didn't see that doing other methods. I became more attached to that stuff. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. I mean, I definitely saw that. I saw how I'm dating this guy and I'm punishing him for the first guy I went out with. I'm seeing that my employer, my fear is based on something that happened to me two jobs ago. That I'm not in the now. I'm in the past or I'm in the fear of the future. And that's not allowing me to be present today. We have begun to learn patience, tolerance, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies, for we look at them as sick people. I started to see that the people that hurt me were hurting. The people who bullied me were also bullied. The guys who broke up with me were just as frightened as I was. We listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. I wanted to run out and make amends. Thank God I didn't, because I would have caused more harm. But I started to want to make things right because I realized that I was, the way I was hurting other people the same way. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope now that you are convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off. If I'm still convinced that I can do it on my own, I'm screwed. What I need to be convinced of is that God can do for me what I cannot do for myself. If you've already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you've made a good beginning. That was one of the things I had to recognize too. When I do the steps off the wall, the only step I see the word inventory in is 4. So if someone said, have you done an inventory? I would say, yeah, because I wrote a lot of diaries. Inventory is steps 4 through 9. It's an inventory process. If you have not completed 4 through 9, you have not done an inventory. And I had to admit I had not done an inventory because I never got to step 9. It says, grosser handicaps. Your being so you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Once again, other big book teachers might feel differently. I really feel that this is just a skill set we're learning. I'm not supposed to be resolving everything going on in my life. I'm learning a skill set that I'm going to implement the rest of my life. I use the simple thing, nursing. I told you I failed out of nursing, so take that into consideration. But you go to nursing school, right? And you learn this skill set in a very clinical environment that you can just practice at your own level. You graduate school, you take your boards, you go into the hospital, and all of a sudden there's a 5-car pileup on the highway and all these patients are coming in. That is where you become a nurse. You become a nurse when you're actually putting that skill set into practice as opposed to, you know, learning how to give a shot on a dummy or an orange, which is what we used to do in the 80s. We'd learn how to use needles with an orange. So all I'm doing right now is learning a skill set that I'm going to implement in 10 and 11. I don't need to take it so seriously. I don't need to get so worked up. There's more work to be done. Okay, so I'm going to do 2 more readings. And then we might even break a little early. Okay, so we didn't really. One of the things I had to skip over for time last night was Roland Hazard. Does everyone know about Roland Hazard and There's a Solution? Anyone not know who Roland Hazard is? Okay, so Roland Hazard is a very important person in AA history, but he's actually not part of the first 100. So the way that it goes is Roland Hazard was a really, really rich guy in the Depression who had access to everything and couldn't stay sober. And his parents exhausted all the psychiatrists in America, and they eventually found Carl Jung. Now, back in the days, and I have a psychology degree from the 80s, and I remember studying these 3 guys in the 80s. But back in the 30s, there was 3 main psychiatrists. One was Sigmund Freud, which most people know of, and he had 2 students. One was Alfred Adler, and one was Carl Jung. Well, the parents went to Freud. He was busy. Adler, he was busy. Carl Jung agreed to see their son. And it wasn't like he just agreed to see their son. He went out and lived with Carl Jung. Now, I have heard a year, I've heard 6 months, I've heard 2 months. Whatever the amount is, he lived with Carl Jung. To me, from the entering recovery in the 90s, I always thought if I can live in that Dr. Phil house, I'll be okay. It's that same exact idea. He leaves, because Carl Jung says, I can do everything, I've done everything I can for you. Go home to America. And once again, it's the 30s, so he's going to travel to England to take a boat back to the United States. And he doesn't make it past France before he's drunk, and he comes back. And he talks to Carl Jung about it. So after he finds, he says, you have to have this spiritual experience. And that's what pages 26 and 27 talk about, that spiritual experience that Carl Jung said, I've done everything I can. Medicine cannot help you. You're 100% hopeless except for a spiritual experience. So Rollinghausen comes back to the United States. He discovers this Oxford group, which is what our 12 steps are based on, the six tenets of the Oxford groups. And he meets Ebbie Thatcher. And he helps Ebbie Thatcher have a spiritual awakening. And part of these tenets are that you have to go witness for the Oxford group. And Ebbie Thatcher, who did not want to do it, came to Bill Wilson. And he told Bill Wilson about the Oxford group. And that was the beginning of our fellowship. Roland Hazard never stayed sober. Ebbie Thatcher never stayed sober. So they're not part of the first 100, but they're absolutely critical in our AA history. So Bill felt so beholden to Dr. Jung that he actually wrote him a letter. And Dr. Jung wrote back to him. So I'm going to read you the letter that Carl Jung wrote back to Bill W. Dear Mr. W., your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news of Roland H. anymore and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversation, which has adequately reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. The reason I could not tell him everything was that in those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland H. But what I really thought about was the result of many experiences of men of his kind. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness expressed in the medieval language, the union with God. How could one formulate such an insight in a language that was not misunderstood in our days? The only right and legitimate way to such an experience is that it happens to you in reality, and it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to a higher understanding. You might be led to that goal by any act of grace or through a personal and honest contact with friends or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of mere rationalism. I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, which was under the circumstances obviously the right one. I am strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world leaves the unrecognized spiritual need in perdition. It is not counteracted either by real religious insight or by the protective wall of human community. An ordinary man not protected by an action from above and isolated in society cannot resist the power of evil, which is called very aptly the devil. But the use of such words arouses so many mistakes then one can only keep aloof from them as much as possible. These are the reasons why I could not give a full and sufficient explanation to Roland H., but I am risking it with you because I conclude from your very decent and honest letter that you have acquired a point of view above the misleading platitudes one usually hears about alcoholism. You see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most deprived poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum, spirit versus spirit. Thank you again for your kind letter. I remain yours sincerely, Carl Jung. So I just love that spirit versus spirit. Which way am I going to go? We talked about those two alternatives. They talk about a thirst. I always say we have a hunger in Overeaters Anonymous for some sort of relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And I was thinking, we don't have spirit versus spirit since it's alcohol, but I was thinking about a month ago, how often do we hear about comfort food? I'm going to make you some comfort food. And what are we told in the doctor's opinion? That we seek the ease and comfort which comes at a bite at once. So are we going to get the comfort from a relationship with a higher power? Or are we going to get the comfort from the food? And that is what Dr. Young was talking about, and that is the question we need to ask ourselves every day. And then lastly, actually that was it, because I think the other one will leave for 6 and 7. So it is 2:57. Do you want to say anything beforehand? Okay, so we're going to come back here at 3:15, and we're going to do 5, 6, 7, and 8.